It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, keeping aging brains active. Research shows that volunteering keeps older people socially engaged, and that is good for their health. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports on one school in Ohio that's put an innovative twist on volunteering.
Start from the beginning.
That's a good place to start.
Okay.
Here's the scene you can find in lots of schools all over the country. An older woman, she's a volunteer in the school, helps a 7-year-old boy read.
His walkie-talkie, the
antenna.
Antenna was damp.
Dangling.
But at this school in Cleveland, many of the volunteers aren't just elderly. They've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Like the woman reading with the boy on the small couch in the school hallway.
But Walter just
ignored him. That's a pretty hard word.
Barbara Kelsey is 84. Her red hair is covered with a silk scarf, folded like a bandana. She's sitting next to a young woman who picks her up at her assisted living facility and drives her to this school. When there's a break in the reading, I ask Kelsey about her volunteer work.
You're a mentor here?
No.
Yes.
I am.
Her name's Barbara Kelsey.
So tell me what you do when you come to the school.
I don't do anything really much except I'd sit and listen to them. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, tell them if they, you know, they don't know exactly how to do something, I help them figure it out.
Sometimes she remembers, but sometimes she doesn't.
I think you met Miss Kelsey.
Kathy Whitehouse is the principal and co-founder of this small inner-city charter school. It's called the Intergenerational School. And part of its philosophy is to bring in lots of volunteers of all ages. Kathy Whitehouse says last year, Barbara Kelsey volunteered more than anyone.
She was the volunteer who was given the Volunteer of the Year award for the most hours at the school last year and turned to her caregiver at the luncheon and said, "Why am I getting this?" And the young woman said to her, "Because you come here and read with the children." And she said, "I do."
Whitehouse says it doesn't matter because Barbara Kelsey is good at what she does.
When you see her sitting with a child and reading, she's able to interact with that child in the moment. She's able to read. I firmly believe that she enjoys the time that she spends here. And if she doesn't remember it 5 minutes later, it doesn't matter. It's just been great to have her.
A person with dementia may no longer be able to read and comprehend an adult book, but Whitehouse realized they can still read a kid's book. Kathy Whitehouse started this school 8 years ago with her husband, Peter. He's a geriatric neurologist.
I think some people who, when they get the label Alzheimer's disease, feel shame, and they themselves withdraw themselves from society.
So Dr. Whitehouse tells his patients with cognitive disabilities to stay socially active, to keep going to the Cleveland Orchestra if they like music, or to volunteer at a school like this one.
I found out that Mrs. Hardesty was dating 3 people.
The volunteers in this room come once a week from a nearby retirement community. Many have mild, but some have advanced dementia. 2 volunteers live on a locked dementia unit. The assignment today is for the students, who are teens and preteens, to ask the older volunteers about lessons and wisdom they can pass on from their life experiences.
But she finally picked her husband because she said they fell in love with each other. And when they tied the knot, he pulled over to the side of the road and said, "I think it's time we just get married." And then she said, "Okay."
For older people with no dementia, research suggests that regular volunteer work increases physical strength and wards off depression and isolation. Volunteers report more cognitive activity. Now Peter Whitehouse is trying to prove that volunteering has health benefits for people with Alzheimer's and dementia too.
We presume, although we're doing the research to try to demonstrate it, that engagement is not only as good but perhaps better and more necessary for older people who have what I call aging-associated cognitive challenges.
He's working with graduate student Daniel George. They've written a book called The Myth of Alzheimer's.
We are looking at whether volunteering at the intergenerational school improves quality of life. And to do that, we're looking at 5 variables: cognitive functioning, stress, depression, sense of purpose, and sense of usefulness.
They tested these volunteers at the start of the school year and then at the end. The study is ongoing and too small, just 20 volunteers, to settle anything. But they say they're able to see change in their volunteers, like Marilee Hardesty. She's 91. Back in her assisted living unit, Hardesty doesn't use the words Alzheimer's or dementia. She talks instead about the thing she calls her problem, and how when it developed last fall, it hit her hard.
And I thought I might as well quit. I was really down in the dumps about the whole thing. There was a time that I hated to go down to dinner because I just couldn't talk to people. It was awful.
Two things lifted her from that despair: a support group of other people dealing with memory loss, and her volunteer work at the Cleveland School.
And the kids, you know, we always find a lot of things to laugh about. Just having kids around has always been very good for me, so it was a good thing.
Not everyone is so sure that the experiment at the intergenerational school can be applied more broadly. Columbia University geriatrician Linda Freed has started a national school volunteer program and researched its health benefits. She thinks it may be impractical to let people with dementia who need help themselves volunteer in schools.
For cognitively impaired older adults, it can feel chaotic because little kids are busy. It can get confusing if you have memory problems and problem-solving problems. So you'd have to learn how to design the environment and have the resources to do that.
The intergenerational school is set up specifically to handle volunteers of all ages and abilities. Mary Kelsey appreciates that. She's the daughter of Barbara Kelsey, the woman who was the volunteer of the year but didn't remember all her volunteer work.
For my mother, helping other people in some way has always been part of how she defines herself.
Before Barbara Kelsey was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 6 years ago, she taught adults how to read. She was a library volunteer who took books to nursing homes and prisons.
One of the great losses of aging in our culture is that people sort of fall out of the place that they had for themselves, the place that has meaning.
So Mary Kelsey tried to restore her mother to a place of meaning. She found the school, and she added something else her mother always liked, music. The next day, at Barbara Kelsey's assisted living facility, the piano teacher shows up.
Are you giving me a lesson? Is that what we're doing?
Oh, my gosh. I haven't had a lesson for a long time. I've forgotten what to do. Oh, my gosh.
She gets music lessons 5 days a week. The teacher, Louis Calataris, takes out the sheet music.
Now, let's start with the Auto Joy. Let's try that once.
I don't even know that very well.
I'll give you the E.
Okay.
That's the E.
The teacher plays the first note, and then Barbara Kelsey plays, tentatively at first, and then with more assurance.
Okay. No.
Some people see Barbara Kelsey as a woman with Alzheimer's.
Do you want me to go on?
But her daughter says if you tell her mother she's got an illness, Barbara Kelsey simply says, "I'm fine." Her daughter says it's something her mother can say because she's still active in the world.
I'm going to play the accompaniment.
Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And a little bit more on memory. Apparently those "it was on the tip of my tongue" moments reveal a lot about how the brain stores information. Get that story at the Your Health section of NPR.org.
This day, June 12th, is a holiday for some Americans. It's not on the federal holiday calendar, but it is on the calendar of Morning Edition commentator John Ridley.
41 years ago, the Green Bay Packers were champs of the first Super Bowl. The Jimi Hendrix Experience released their debut album. And interracial couples could still not legally marry in 16 of these 50 United States. Hence the significance of June 12th, Loving Day, a little observed but considerable day of remembrance, particularly for those with some connection to an interracial relationship, as Loving Day marks the end of one of the last slave laws that remained on the books in many southern states. Now, Loving Day is not named for the emotion Loving, but fittingly for Richard Loving and his wife Mildred. Richard was white and Mildred was black, and when they were married in 1958, their home state of Virginia was one of those 16 that considered the two of them being together just plain criminal. Now, for a lot of you youngsters raised in a multicultural society, I'm sure it's hard to believe people could get so bent they'd actually write laws restricting affairs of the heart. But interracial marriage was once a severely odious concept. In 1912, Congressman Seaborn Roddenberry of Georgia tried to introduce an amendment to the Constitution banning such unions. To his colleagues in Congress, he lectured, "It is contrary and averse to every sentiment of pure American spirit. No more voracious parasite ever sucked at the heart of pure society and moral status than the one which welcomes or recognizes everywhere the sacred ties of wedlock between Africa and America." Aren't you glad we're living in a time when politicians don't use relationships between consenting adults as wedge issues? But I digress. The Lovings spent time in jail for the high crime of being married to each other, were forced to move from Virginia. And then on June 12th of 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Lovings' criminal convictions and struck down all laws against interracial marriage. Though their only desire was to spend a lifetime together, sadly, it was not meant to be for the Lovings. Richard was killed in a 1975 car accident. Mildred passed away on May 2nd of this year. Well, they're together again now. And for millions of mixed-race couples and their families, this Loving Day is one to be particularly celebrated. It arrives on the heels of history and is personified in Barack Obama's candidacy. 41 years after the laws were struck down, just 41 years, and now the son of a relationship once considered contrary to every sentiment of pure American spirit is one step removed from the American people, placing him into the highest office in the land.
Commentator John Ridley.
And if you've ever tried to drive the L.A. freeway, you know it's slow going. Back in April, a couple bike activists in Santa Monica saw a traffic jam and figured they'd use it to their own advantage. They call themselves criminals, like criminal animals, and they stage all sorts of protests to make the point that cyclists deserve a real space on the road. But their usual MO, biking through traffic jams on the surface streets of Los Angeles, never got as much attention as their latest endeavor, pedaling up an on-ramp and riding down the interstate. Rachel Martin spoke with the criminals, Morgan Strauss and Alex Contarero, about why they do what they do.
You have done things like this before, as we say, these kinds of public demonstrations to illustrate the efficiency of bike riding as opposed to driving, especially in L.A. But what in the world made you think, ah, yes, we should take this to the freeway? I mean, do you have a secret death wish?
No, I want to live a long life. I think I just wanted to flirt with some transportation taboos and make my way through traffic. It looked safer than Olympic or Wilshire Boulevards.
Wow, really? So let's start with what was going through your head. Morgan, when you headed up on that first on-ramp, what was going through your mind? Did you have any doubts?
Yeah, I was scared to death. I didn't know what it was going to look like when we got up there. It turned out to be totally fine, but I guess it was kind of like a near-death experience, but without death being nearby. Everything was happening really slow. I started to take an inventory of my life and kind of assess the things that I had achieved in life and all the things I hadn't and all my regrets and wants. And then I set them aside as soon as I started swerving through traffic.
Alex, what kind of response did you get from the drivers you passed? Because I have to say, if I were on the freeway and I saw you two hauling down the road, I would be a little miffed. I'd be like, what in the bleep are those guys doing?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, that's what we expected. I expected a cacophony of horns and beep, beep, beeps and people hooting and hollering, kind of like when we participate in bigger group rides. But much to my surprise and part disappointment, a lot of drivers, they were just mummified in their car. You know, they would look at us, glance back to their cell phones because they were text messaging. Some people looked up and, you know, they flipped back the radio station, looked back like, oh, I'm in traffic. So it was surprising that a lot of people didn't react the way we thought they would, at least with the, like, what are these guys doing?
Yeah. You know? How many of you were on the ride? Was it just the two of you or were there more?
The first ride was 15 total.
15 riders.
15 riders total.
Wow. I'm really shocked that nobody was more flabbergasted.
I saw maybe like two people out of like the thousands, I guess, that I passed by that were like, maybe not thousands, a few hundreds, but, you know, two of them maybe looked at me and smiled, and that's about that. The second ride, we got a much larger response, but that was the freak show ride.
What do you mean it was a freak show ride?
Oh, we had a few rollerbladers, people in costumes, and a guy
on a triple tall bike.
So this was a second freeway ride that you staged. This was May 9th, I understand. Did you get, you got more of a reaction because people were in costume?
Yeah. And I think the energy level overall was just different the second ride. I think, you know, we'd kind of broken a barrier with the first ride, and people were a little, the riders I'm talking about were just a little less kind of guarded and a little bit more excited to get people's attention. Mm-hmm. They weren't just trying to get from point A to point B. They were trying to have fun along the way.
So let's talk about what the message is. I mean, first of all, did you set a goal? Were you trying to prove something like, okay, we're going to get on the on-ramp here at the freeway and we are going to get off at this point and we can guarantee you we're going to get there before a car does?
One of the early ideas for a traffic jam ride came, and I think me and one of my friends at a bicycle co-op I volunteer at, we were talking about riding a big group of bicycles into traffic jam on a boulevard, not a freeway, and just handing out people flyers that I made that say, like, if you rode a bike, you'd be home by now, and just hand them out, you know, kind of saying, you know, your commute from point A to point B is, you know, 4 miles on a car, you're doing it in about 40 minutes. On a bike, you're there in 6. So that was the early idea, like touting the benefits of cycling, you know, no insurance, no gas, no parking, et cetera,
now,
lose weight, you know?
All those sound like great benefits, and it's a really great idea, but aren't you targeting the wrong audience, perhaps? I mean, the fact that you rode on the freeway, we should point out, is illegal. And so you can't just tell everyone, hey, ditch your cars and hop on a bike and we'll cruise down the freeway and make your commute shorter. I mean, should you be targeting perhaps policymakers who can do something about maybe creating more bike paths?
You know, I think that's kind of the blurred, the confusion in activism is that there are activists and there are policymakers, and I'm an activist. I'm not a policymaker. I'm not riding on the freeway to promote riding on the freeway. I'm riding on the freeway just to show people that these are bicycles. They have two wheels. They're not propelled by gas. They're propelled by my legs, and anybody can ride one, you know, provided they're in the shape to do it.
Is your dream utopia that there are no cars, or do you accept that cars are part of our reality? You'd just like to see more bicycles.
Yeah, cars are part of our reality, but I'm not afraid to dream big and and see a future of only bikes and monorails and trains and, you know, perhaps
more public transit as well.
City vehicles. Yeah, we're not only about bicycles. I bike and I bus, and, you know, without people showing other people that this is what's going on, nobody's gonna have that spark in their head and think, huh, bicycle, faster.
Mm-hmm. I understand that the fuzz, if you will, did show up the second time. We talked to the California Highway Patrol, and they said that if they caught you doing this, that they'd give you a ticket of about $100. Does that scare you? I guess not.
Absolutely. We thought it was like $250. That's a lot cheaper.
$100. Even if I got one of those a month for riding on the freeway, that's less than gasoline.
Are you planning on doing this again?
Yes.
When?
Soon. Coming soon to an on-ramp near you.
Coming soon to an on-ramp. And do you plan on doing this? Is there something particularly profound about doing it in L.A., or do you plan to do it in other urban centers?
We'd like to do it in France. We'd like to do it wherever there's a traffic jam. You'll find us.
We're a big fan of the iPhone feature that shows the sig alert congestion on Google Maps. We like to look at that from time to time and think of what it'd be like to ride through the red line.
Morgan Strauss and Alex Cantarero are part of the Criminimals, a bicycle advocacy group. Morgan and Alex, hey, you two, thanks very much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
And that was Rachel Martin, who wrangled the Criminimals. And there is a video of their first ride on our blog.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
I'm Steve Inskeep. It's been 14 years now since South Africa formally ended the racial system known as apartheid. That's long enough for thousands of children to go through school and graduate. The trouble is they've gone through schools that were twisted for decades, and 14 years have not been long enough to fix them. In the latest report in her series, NPR's Charlene Hunter-Galt continues educating us on South Africa today.
It's Thursday at Rehola Primary School, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing because it's lunchtime, and plates are being passed out to the 1,600 students who will enjoy a rich stew of beans and rice. But Friday is another story.
No food.
Nakamani Majola is the school's principal.
The fifth day they stay without food, and that makes them also not to come to school.
because what drives them to come to school is when they eat, because there is nothing at home.
But Jola tells me most of the families in the area are black and poor, having been retrenched from the now less productive gold mines nearby.
The ceiling is falling.
Majola says the government is trying, but the budget allocations are still not enough to renovate the 25-year-old building with ceilings falling down or otherwise meet the needs of his students, many of whom are HIV-positive orphans, many sick, and of course, hungry.
It does affect learning, of course. You know, a child cannot learn with an empty stomach. Concentration, moreover, I'm dealing with the young learners. They must get food in order to be energetic to sustain the whole day.
They needed everything.
Jan Pascal is an American whose organization, Every Child is Ours, has helped bring books to this and several other schools in the area to fill near-empty bookshelves. But, she says, when she first came...
They needed books, they needed school supplies, and I knew that if we could get things that they would utilize them in the way that anyone would want them to.
Although the school can't afford chairs, the library shelves are now filled with math books and other reading materials from America. But many of the country's schools opened this year with no books, and that, in part, has led to steadily decreasing student performance in the past 11 years of the country's multiracial democracy. For example, studies show every year, on average, for the past 4 years, only 17% of high school graduates achieved grades high enough to enter college. But according to Mary Metcalf, head of the School of Education at Johannesburg's University of the Witwatersrand, the educational deficits are revealed even earlier.
Children as few years as 3 years into school are already not performing as well as they are patently able to do.
Metcalf says these results are rooted in the country's historic system of apartheid, where the white minority government deliberately undereducated blacks to keep them subservient. One of the first tasks of the new black-led government after it came to power in 1994 was dismantling the 14 separate and unequal ethnically based school systems that favored whites. The government created what it hoped would be a more equitable, unified system. But the inequities remain, say experts like Metcalf.
It's the children of the poor who we continue to fail. And that, of course, coincides as a class issue with race in our country as an historic fact.
Metcalf is among those who worried about the consequences of such a severely challenged education system.
If you look at the number of young people who left school between 2005 and 2007, there's 500,000 who've left with no school leaving certificate and who have very little chance of doing anything other than competing for very lowly skilled employment opportunities.
South Africa's education minister has acknowledged the poor state of education and has insisted that government and its partners find new ways of fixing both the dilapidated buildings and student pass rates. And the new leadership of the ruling African National Congress Party insists there will be new approaches after the presidential election in 2009, including reopening of teacher training institutions that will increase the number of qualified teachers, especially in the poor rural areas. Ruling ANC Party spokesman Jesse Duarte.
The preoccupation after 2009 will be training, training, and more training.
Meanwhile, despite the myriad challenges he's facing at Rayahola Primary School, as Principal Majola looks out on the young people in his care, he's hopeful, not least because of his own experiences when he was their age.
I've gone through apartheid. I attended very poor schools in farms. And I think with the little knowledge that I've acquired through the help of my parents, that keeps me going. We are still a new democratic country. Things will develop with time because we are starting, I think, for something new to come out clear, we need to go through some challenges. And hence, I think, if we are focused, we'll get there.
The future of the country depends on such hope. Charlene Huntergault, NPR News, Orkney, South Africa.
You're only hearing this coverage on Morning Edition, and tomorrow we'll look at South Africa's public health care and explain why it's in poor health. You can hear more stories in our series on South Africa at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. 2008 is shaping up to be the year of the whistleblower at the Federal Aviation Administration. So far, 32 men and women have come forward. They're worried that our skies aren't as safe as they could be. The FAA saw just 11 whistleblowers in all of last year. The agency has responded with new systems for reporting safety issues. It also says, finding a silver lining, that this situation proves it has dedicated workers who put public safety first. But as NPR's Wade Goodwin reports, being a whistleblower can ruin a career.
Peter Nesbitt was a veteran controller with 17 years of experience when he was transferred from Austin, Texas, to the control tower at Memphis International Airport. Northwest Airlines and FedEx use Memphis as a base of operations, and Nesbitt liked working the night shift in particular. There was just one thing. During those times when the airport got a big push of inbound traffic, controllers were instructed to use all four runways for landing, and Nesbitt thought this was an invitation to disaster.
When I saw the operation, I asked some of my peers and I asked some of the supervisors, hey, what's up with this procedure? This looks kind of scary.
Imagine three parallel runways next to each other like rows of corn. Now, the fourth runway at Memphis International runs across the end. If all the landings go well, it's no problem. But if the plane landing on the crossing runway needs to execute what is called a go-around, then its flight path could take it directly into the flight path of the other planes on approach. And this happens occasionally at Memphis. In fact, last year, a Northwest Air DC-9 almost collided in midair with a commuter plane while Peter Nesbitt watched from the control tower.
I observed a Saab Fairchild, which is a twin-engine turboprop, on approach to land on runway 27.
That's the crossing runway.
At about that same time, there was a DC-9, a turbojet, that was on approach to land on runway 18 left.
That runway is perpendicular.
As the Saab Fairchild approached the runway, the pilot informed the local controller that he was going around due to an unsafe gear indication.
As the jet and the commuter plane converged, the controller handling the landing began to plead with the turboprop pilot to stay low, stay low, stay low.
The Saab Fairchild kind of pushed the nose over and stayed low as he could to the runway and flew down the length of runway 27.
At the same time, the pilot flying the Northwest DC-9 jammed his throttles forward, pulled back the stick, and clawed for the sky. The commuter plane ended up flying right underneath him, and it was close.
I estimate that it was probably 800 feet or less vertical separation. That's the closest we had seen two airplanes come together in, at least in my career, and I believe probably the other controller's career as well.
Nesbitt says managers always told the controllers at Memphis International that the airport had a special waiver from the FAA to land planes this way. When the controllers asked to see the waiver, Nesbitt says they were told it wasn't in Memphis, it was kept in Atlanta, and they didn't need to worry about it. The truth was, both Memphis airport officials and FedEx executives publicly supported having the four runways landing during peak operations. But now Nesbitt was too frightened to let it go.
I went straight downstairs and I filled out a NASA aviation safety reporting report and submitted it to NASA that night. After that, I contacted the National Transportation Safety Board and I sent them an email expressing concerns about the runway 27 operation also.
From the beginning, Peter Nesbitt was worried about retaliation, and federal investigators quickly uncovered embarrassing information. Memphis International, in fact, did not have a waiver to conduct that controversial landing procedure, and the FAA ordered it stopped immediately. But the desire to maintain the status quo was strong, and Memphis managers continued to land planes in the same operation until Nesbitt again busted them. That's according to FAA documents. Nesbitt says then the retaliation against him was quick and intense. Over the last year, managers in Memphis have decertified the whistleblower for alleged performance issues.
It's been excruciating. It's been very disturbing. I feel like I've tried to do the right thing. I've tried to enhance safety, and I feel that I've paid a price for it.
And Nesbitt is not alone. Two Dallas-based FAA aircraft inspectors went before the House Transportation Committee in April and gave blistering testimony about how the FAA had abandoned its own aircraft inspection protocols.
I'd like to thank all of you for coming today to help us honor Bobby Boutrous and Doug Peters for their integrity and their brave acts on behalf of the American public.
At a ceremony yesterday in Washington, D.C., Bobby Boutrous and Doug Peters were honored by the Office of Special Counsel for their service to the country. While accepting his public servant award, Inspector Boutrous described the retaliation he endured.
When I came forward, the next step was put me under investigation for 6 months, take my inspector duties away, and tell me I have stayed in my cube and look at the four walls.
FAA officials refused to comment specifically about the allegations of retaliation by any particular whistleblower, but the agency says in the last few weeks it has put in place new procedures designed to facilitate reports by controllers and inspectors of unsafe conditions. FAA spokesperson Diane Spitaleri says they've replaced some of the FAA managers at Dallas-Fort Worth International, too.
We brought in some experienced managers from other facilities in different parts of the country, and they have been working very closely with the whistleblowers to make sure their concerns are heard and that they're comfortable in their operating environment.
But ask Ann Whiteman, a controller who was the first to go public about problems inside the tower at DFW a decade ago, and she will tell you it's no fun being an FAA whistleblower.
No, they did things blatant. They tried to run me off the road. Guy knocked me down. He used to knock me down at work all the time. He'd walk by. If nobody was looking, he'd knock me down.
The physical abuse was witnessed and documented by the FAA. Whiteman blew the whistle on managers at DFW for covering up incidents involving aircraft flying too close to one another. Managers in the DFW tower retaliated by declaring her medically unfit for duty. While the top brass of the FAA in Washington now admits it's had an ongoing problem at DFW, Whiteman says that for her, it doesn't matter. The retaliation never stops. After 10 years, she's worn down.
I used to say I would do it again. Not so sure. Twice now, I've been removed from my job. The most recent instance, I was locked in the office. I'll never be the same old Annie again. They've changed me in many ways. But I do have my pride. I do have a sense that I did the right thing. But I have a whole lot of sadness I don't think I would have ever had.
Whiteman's account and supporting testimony by witnesses was documented by the federal government. For their part, managers at DFW disputed the door was locked. To be an FAA whistleblower is to be an outcast, and it takes certain qualities of character to take up the service. But the dangers they eventually report weigh heavy on their conscience. It is their fear of the soul-crushing guilt they would suffer if the worst actually were to happen and they'd done nothing to stop it. It is a bad hand to be dealt. Go public, don't go public. It's a lose-lose proposition. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
The neighborhoods of North Minneapolis have long been a bit rougher and poorer than the rest of the city. Now, with the mortgage foreclosure crisis, the troubles there have multiplied. Today, in some parts of the city, one in seven houses is abandoned. In the first of two reports, NPR's Jim Zaroli looks at how the foreclosure crisis is playing out there in North Minneapolis.
Nellie Campbell sweeps the twigs and grass off the walkway of her home on Aldrich Avenue. Campbell remembers when she knew almost all of her neighbors, and most of them owned the homes they lived in. These days, only a few do.
All the rest of the houses is sold, or somebody's renting them.
How many houses are vacant right now?
It's about eight.
Eight right here on the street?
On this block, yes. Never before. To me, it's like a ghost town.
What's happened here has happened all over North Minneapolis. In the space of a few years, longtime residents have fled, property values have tanked, and hundreds of homes have been abandoned. R.T. Ryback is Minneapolis's mayor.
Unfortunately, when America gets a cold, neighborhoods like North Minneapolis get pneumonia, and foreclosure hit much harder there than other parts of town.
The changes here have come with dizzying speed. For decades, North Minneapolis has been known as a tough, working-class neighborhood. It's got the highest concentrations of African Americans in a heavily white city. A few years ago, during the mortgage boom, North Minneapolis was discovered by investors. They liked the cozy, tree-lined streets close to downtown, and they liked the solid old bungalows that could be bought cheap and rented out. Many of the most stable, long-time residents drifted away.
Yeah, ready?
Joel Bregeman tosses a tattered soccer ball across his lawn and watches his dog, Cooper, run after it.
Look at it.
Bregeman's yard on DuPont Avenue North is surrounded by a wooden fence. He built it because he wanted more privacy. Bregeman says the newcomers in the neighborhood have tended to be a rougher crowd than those they displaced.
Blatant drug dealing, residents who spent their entire day out on the front step of the house drinking from 8 in the morning till 2 o'clock in the morning, and would have their car parked in the street in front of the house with music blaring to the point where I wasn't able to ever even enjoy my own screen porch because the music was so loud at the house behind me, you couldn't hear yourself think.
The area's troubles have been greatly aggravated by mortgage fraud, says Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Dixon.
There are always victims in fraud cases, but the kinds of cases that we've been prosecuting in the last year have had a dramatic impact on the communities in which these properties are located.
The most notorious case involved a firm called TJ Waconia. U.S. officials say the company sold properties at inflated prices using fraudulent appraisals. The founders later pleaded guilty to mail fraud, and 141 North Minneapolis houses once owned by the firm now sit empty. The fraud helped drive house prices to artificially high levels, and when the subprime market collapsed, North Minneapolis was left with hundreds of foreclosed properties. These houses have become magnets for crime. Today, a Minneapolis police sergeant is sealing the doors of one house with plywood. The overgrown lawn is choked with dandelions, and a yellow foreclosure notice is stuck to a window. This house was taken over by gangs who used it to sell drugs. Crime prevention specialist Tim Hammett says that if houses like these aren't sealed up quickly, vandals strip them bare.
I came home from lunch one day, and I saw a woman who was blatantly just tearing siding, aluminum siding, off the house. I walk up to her and say, "What the heck do you think you're doing?" And she says, "Nobody's living here. Who cares?"
The vandalism can have dangerous consequences. Three times this year, houses exploded and burned because thieves stole the copper piping without shutting off the gas. The city is buying some of the vacant homes from the banks that own them. The hope is that by reclaiming and renovating these properties, they can lure back stable families. Again, Mayor Ryback.
These neighborhoods, which have very good housing stock, can attract good, solid homeowners. The problem is that we have been dealing on such a large scale because we have so many foreclosures and so many of these properties tied up with predatory lenders.
But the subprime crisis has sent prices tumbling back down again, and a new generation of investors is buying up a lot of foreclosed properties. City officials worry that a lot of these will end up as inexpensive rentals, and that's led to a new struggle over North Minneapolis's future. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Tomorrow, Minneapolis tries to lure home buyers back to the North Side.